You are listening to the GeoNiagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of the GeoNiagara Radio Show. I'm Darren.
And I'm RJ.
And if you're wondering why RJ's a little bit out of breath,
I am.
She just rolled into the studio so we could record our intro. Mm-hmm. Where were you?
I was at the Brock Tourism Networking event tonight. So this happened on April 10th, and it was really great. There was lots of tourism professionals there, and many people from the Geography and Tourism Department as well for us to talk to. And they had a round table, so basically we had five rotations of 15 minutes where we could talk to selected professionals around the room. It was a really great opportunity, lots of people to talk to, and lots of great tips for students for shared, and how we can kind of break out into the industry. But a lot of the people, I think almost every single one of them said they came into the tourism industry by accident. So it's always an interesting journey.
That seems to be like a common, yeah. Not only does it happen in geography, it also happens in tourism.
Absolutely.
So a wide variety of sectors there.
Yeah.
Like the cycling, tourism.
The cycling tourism was definitely interesting. There was also a hostel as a sponsor there, and a couple of different not-for-profits that do tourism around Niagara.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Maybe, hopefully this will become a yearly event, and maybe next year we can get out there with a portable recorder and do some
That would be great.
Spot interviews with people and see how they enjoyed it.
It seemed quite successful, and it was the first time running, and I really enjoyed it, and they had a great turnout. So yeah.
I've participated in these types of sort of, it's almost like a speed dating for tourism.
Yeah, it is.
You know, where you get you know, you're the main person at the table, and then you have a crowd of people come and ask you questions. It was, well, the co-op program I participated in.
Yep.
One of those types of things where they were talking about.
Yeah, I remember
about,
you being there, actually.
You had to look through everybody's resume or...
I probably landed my first co-op job from that exact round table that I saw you there, actually.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, so they're definitely help. And all of them had... one of their number one comments was also just networking. And it's not about you showing up for the interview. It's about how you networked and all the things you did before you got to that interview position. Mm-hmm. So
I think one of the weird things was for me was I'm not the typical employer.
No.
So when I had students come up to me, I'm always like a face-to-face person. Like I would prefer to meet at a restaurant to sort of get to know somebody, you know, sort of like an informal interview rather than let's sit down in this office space and I grill you with questions. Like mm-hmm. I'd rather learn more about them and their passions. And I mean, you can teach skills, but you can't teach passion for a subject or passion for the position.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's absolutely true.
Which I think is even more important than, you know, people fitting the culture of an organization. It's like, well, people can learn to be part of a culture of an office, but the passion, if they got a passion for the subject, that means more to me than anything in hiring somebody. So
one of the employers there was mentioning how basically he only hires people based on if they pass the crazy test or not.
And what is the crazy test?
The crazy test would just be that they can show up to an interview and form logical and reasonable answers, and you feel like you can be in a work environment with them. But you just don't know that until you really sit down and kind of get that face-to-face value from it, you know?
That's awesome.
So the crazy test, which I had never expected to hear at a professional tourism event.
So for me, this weekend, first of all, after the, March's episode aired with Colleen, which mm-hmm. was a fantastic episode, I attended her presentation of the Historic Well and Canals Mapping Project at the downtown library here in St. Catharines. There were a ton of people showed up for that. It was really
amazing.
It was really cool to see a great cross-section of the community, young and old as well. And listening to her story of how she did the mapping and all the information that she collected was just really inspiring. And I ended up meeting a gentleman named Renee, who is, I guess, Colleen's sort of co-explorer, as it were. And he works, he has this passion project called the Welland Canals Advocate. And what he's doing is he's doing guided hiking tours through the first and second Welland Canal areas. So he did a hiking tour this past Sunday of five of the locks for the second Welland Canal. And 35 people showed up for that.
Nice.
And it was really, really cool to see this infrastructure that, for all intents and purposes, is really hidden right now. No one, I don't want to say no one appreciates it, but I don't think a lot of people realize that it's there. And it is an absolute diamond in the rough in terms of what types of tourism and sort of educational opportunities that this infrastructure provides.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk a little bit more. He's got a later on in the events, but he has a another guided hiking tour on Sunday, May the 6th. And I had that written down. And I'll have to look it up a little bit more later on in the show.
Sounds good.
So we have a jam-packed show today.
We should. We should probably just get to it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we'll introduce the people that are on the show. First, we have Alia McIntosh. She is a GIS student at Niagara College in the GIS and Geospatial Management program. And she's going to be talking about her cemetery project that she's working on, which is very interesting. Lots of GIS work with cemeteries lately.
Mm-hmm. More necrogeography.
More necrogeography. It never ends. And then we have Paul Michael Pilkington.
Yep.
And
who is a friend of mine and a master's candidate in the Earth Science Department of Brock University. And I can't try to say that word again, so you'll hear about it later.
I was waiting for you to say it.
I'm not going to embarrass myself again.
He's a master's candidate, and he is studying paleolimnology.
I'm just so mad at myself.
And finally, after Paul Michael, we will have Kyle Rankin. Kyle Rankin is a graduate of the Niagara College GIS and Geospatial Management program, but he is the final student that went through with the concurrent concentration in geomatics from the program that was formerly combined between Brock University and Niagara College. So Kyle is actually finishing up his fourth year at Brock. And he's also the recipient of the 2018 ESRI Award. And
the ESRI GIS Scholarship.
Yep. And he is, his project was the sports analytics using GIS. So without further ado, here are today's guests. Joining us on the Geo Niagara Radio Show now is Alia McIntosh. She is a Bachelor of Science Honors degree holder in Animal Biology from the University of Guelph, and she is currently in the Niagara College Postgraduate GIS Geospatial Management Program. Thank you for joining us in the studio.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the questions I usually ask of our interviewees is sort of your path, your educational path to where you are now at Niagara College.
Yeah, well, I, as you mentioned, I started at the University of Guelph in animal biology. It's quite a different path that I've taken from there to get to here. It's been a few years, it's been 4 years since I graduated. So I just took a turn for, well, it was a change.
How many other programs did you investigate before deciding on the Niagara College program?
Only a couple. I had spoken with some contacts who are in the GIS field right now, and I was asked about different programs, and Niagara College was one of the top ones that came up, and I looked into it further, and I really liked the idea of doing a thesis project because I had my own idea for that, and so here I am.
We'll talk a little bit more about your thesis project in a little bit. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is some of the work that you did at the University of Guelph, the Long Point Bird Observatory. Can you give us an idea of what that project was about? Because I see that you outfitted birds with geolocator devices, which couldn't be the most easy thing to do, I would imagine.
No. So that was in the summer of 2012. It was a volunteer project. So anybody who had this interest in migratory birds, tree swallows in particular, we would stay out at Long Point, and there were three stations there. We only went to two. There was the Tip and Old Cut, and you would band the birds. You'd capture the birds and band the birds. And then for some of the selected few, we would put geolocators on, just to track their migratory patterns. And that wasn't the main focus of the project. It was more just, it's an ongoing study. It's been going on for 30 years or so. It's an ongoing project.
I get this vision in my head of a little tiny GoPro unit. Like, was it a bird? Was it a collar?
Yeah.
Or was it on their leg?
What happened is they're essentially backpacks for birds, but they're very tiny, probably about the size of your thumbnail, the actual backpack part, and then the challenging part was to get them over their wings because of the length of their feathers. You'd have to be able to pull them through that tiny loop, and you can't let that loop fall off too, so it can't be too big, but it can't be too small either.
Those birds can't enjoy that feeling too much.
I don't think they did. No.
So was this part of like a Bird Studies Canada project?
Yes, and that's the thing. It's a joint study between the University of Guelph and Bird Studies Canada.
So moving on to your thesis project at Niagara College, you are working with the Evergreen Cemetery Company in Lindock, Ontario?
Yeah, so it's a tiny hamlet in Norfolk County. The cemetery is a privately run cemetery, so it's run by a board of directors, again, all of which who are volunteers. And so the project is about mapping the cemetery, because currently they have a bunch of hard copy maps that are, you know, they're handwritten, and so are their burial records. Actually, only recently transferred to an Excel format, the records themselves. So the idea is to get everything on a computer and computerized.
You've done some volunteer work for them in the past. So did you go into the program knowing exactly what you wanted to do in terms of a thesis project, and then sold that to them in terms of what you could do?
So when I volunteered with the cemetery, I got some experience putting in cornerstones, and that's the first-hand experience I got working with their handwritten maps. And so through that, the idea they already had is that they would like a better method. And with this newfound direction into GIS for myself, I was able to put two and two together and figure perhaps there's a way that we can do this together. A good opportunity.
So I would imagine probably one of the hardest parts of the project is deciphering handwritten records. What is the general range of cemetery plots in terms of age? Like, how far does this cemetery go back?
The earliest burial is from 1833 to 2017 is what I have right now, because I haven't gotten the 2018 records.
Right.
But yes, quite a range. It's interesting because the cemetery company wasn't founded until 1879. So there are actually burials from before the company was put together, which is mysterious in a way, but perhaps it isn't. That'll be something to be considered later.
So being run by, so this is not a, most cemeteries are either owned by a municipality or run by a municipality. This is a completely private enterprise.
Run. Yep.
That can't be, are they looking to, do they have the ability to expand, and are they planning that expansion through this project, or is it just pretty much limited to catching up on the records, as it were?
Yeah, for the most part, it is about catching up. There are a total of 2,449 graves. So if there are four people that are capable to be buried in one grave, then the graves are filling up. That's the point here. Mm-hmm. And there isn't really any intention of expanding the cemetery because the space is limited.
Right.
It's bordered by a valley, essentially. So
the ultimate goal is of the project is to make it easily accessible for the cemetery staff to enter data and input data. How are you planning on doing that without vast amounts of cost to what seems to be a rather small enterprise in terms of funds?
Well, that's the great benefit of QGIS, especially since the cemetery doesn't necessarily have the means to purchase other software.
So are you creating a step through how to enter data into the software?
Yes, that that is a portion of my project. The cemetery volunteers don't necessarily have the technology background that I do. They don't have as much experience with computers, so it will be absolutely necessary to have a user guide for them, especially for inputting data, because that is how it will be entered into the GIS.
So currently, where are you in the process of the project at this time?
So up until now, what I've done is I've gone out into the field and surveyed some control points. And from there, I've taken those points and I have georeferenced a previous survey plan. And from that survey plan, I was able to digitize the graves, the plots, and the sections. So now it's about linking the features that have been digitized to the burial records.
So after your project is completed for the Evergreen Cemetery Company, where do you see that going from there?
Well, for the most part, it will all be about maintaining this database, the burial records, perhaps making that available to the public. That could be an option. However, that's more the decision of the Evergreen Cemetery Company. I know web apps are a big thing with cemeteries. The largest cemetery in Canada, in Montreal, they're all online. I know there's one in Peterborough, also online. It's about making it available to the public, and it's great for genealogical records and people who are interested in their ancestry. So it's an interesting possibility.
Is there an associated image of the headstones for each of these records as well?
Not yet. That is also an option, because you can always attach images to a database. Again, that would just take time to go out into the field and take those pictures.
Because I know there is an app called the Billion Graves app that actually, I guess you could say it's like a crowdsourced cemetery inventory project, but it's more aligned to sort of an ancestry, like a genealogy type of app, where they have pictures of headstones from cemeteries all over the world, and it's like a searchable database for that. It's really neat. You should take a look at that.
I will.
So your time at Niagara College, what's been your experience in the program so far? Are you finding it challenging? Is it demanding? Like, I realize with the recent college strike, things have been condensed vastly, and has that been an issue?
Well, first off, I would like to start by saying I love this program. It's been awesome. It has been demanding, and it's had its challenges. And the strike, of course, put us back a little. But I think in the end, it can all be brought together, and I'm looking forward to the results that comes out of this program. So far, I'm happy with it.
We should also mention that the final thesis presentations will be held in June, and those presentations are open to the public. And the GeoNiagara Radio Show will have... we'll post the date of those presentations, because they are open to the public. So if anybody is even remotely interested in geography, geospatial technologies, or even to see specifically how GIS is used in the context of cemeteries or in a number of other projects, the public is more than welcome to attend these presentations. The Niagara College program ends and finishes in June. Do you have any plans after that? Like, what are you hoping to do?
Ideally, I would love to have a position in the GIS field, whether it be within a municipality or a private organization. Private versus public isn't as much a concern for me. It's about the work that's being done.
Would you consider continuing on with assisting cemeteries?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been fun so far.
At this point in time, I would like to thank Alia for coming out and telling us about her project, and I look forward to seeing the results at in the beginning of June. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Thinking of pursuing a career in the field of geography or tourism? The Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University offers 3 and 4 year bachelor's degrees and a geography graduate program, each with several study options. At Brock University, you'll get an excellent education with hands-on experience through internships, study abroad programs, co-op, labs, seminars, and more. Explore the world through your studies. Come to Brock and experience the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies today. Check us out at brocku.ca/geotour.
All right. Sitting in the studio today with Paul Michael Pilkington. He is a candidate for a Master of Science in the Earth Science Department on the topic of paleolimnology. We're all going to learn something new today. How are you doing today, Paul?
Pretty good. Can't complain. Thank you for the introduction. Appreciate it.
No problem. So why don't we start by you telling me a bit about your background, where you're from, and where you've ended up so far.
Perfect. Well, my background, I'm actually born and raised in Canada, Niagara Falls more specifically. So been in Niagara my whole life. My parents, they're born in Canada. My dad's definitely more hardcore Canadian, but his background's more Irish. My mother, she grew up in Italy. She was, obviously, like I said, she was born and raised in Canada, but definitely some heavy Italian roots on her side. And I definitely identify more with my Italian-Canadian side than my Irish side, but I mean, I can't not celebrate St. Paddy's Day, so.
Awesome. Why did you decide to pursue environmental geoscience in your undergraduate degree?
That's a good question. So before I actually started my undergraduate degree, I was contemplating what to get into, and I was either contemplating between more engineering or maybe going into medical sciences to be a doctor. And at the end of the day, I realized that there's a lot of responsibility behind being an engineer, and I was definitely an energetic and creative individual, so designing was definitely up my alley. But the more I thought about it, I definitely felt closer to the environment around me. And being born and raised in Niagara, being surrounded by the Great Lakes, it's hard not to, I guess, take in the beauty of what's actually around us. So I think that's definitely what heavily influenced me to go towards the environmental geology section than more towards engineering or being a doctor. Yeah, definitely more fun in my day, I'd say, than those professions.
Awesome. And why did you decide to pursue Brock for this?
Well, the truth, it actually comes down to my past decisions as well, because I originally applied to go to mechatronics engineering, I believe, at Waterloo and Western, and I had Brock as a backup. I was going to go there to pursue computer science and then eventually switch to these schools afterwards. But after being accepted at Brock and realizing I wasn't going to get an engineering school first year, I realized, is this really for me? And then I realized that I prefer to study all sciences. I love my physics, my chemistry, my biology. And if I was going towards more of an engineering degree, then I wouldn't be able to fulfill all these compartments of knowledge. And I think that's why I made the decision to switch my degree from computer science at Brock to environmental geoscience. And it's been probably the best decision I've made in my academic career.
You're not alone. Almost everyone that we've ever brought into the studio has had some weird winding path to how they ended up, especially in our science or geography careers. So that's definitely a unique one, that's for sure. Here on your CV, during your undergrad, it says you completed an environmental assessment up on the 12 Mile Creek here in the Niagara region. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a class actually ran by Dr. Brand. He's been doing it for a few years, I think at least 20 years now. And his class and his own research basically has been monitoring the change of the 12 Mile Creek watershed in regards to mainly development in the area and how that influences, I guess, the water quality on the watershed, but then also the brook trout, I believe, is a fish in that watershed that can actually be impacted by human development. So yeah, definitely a great course, but definitely wasn't the only assessment course I'd say I took at Brock. Another one was actually during my master's. It was last year. Dr. Brand and a couple other grad students in the Earth Science Department, we did an audit on Brock University, and what I was in charge of was the energy audit. So we basically went around not only the Earth Science Department at Brock, but almost all departments at Brock to basically see the amount of light emitted from various rooms and see if it was up to standards with the Ontario Lighting Guide and the Canadian Lighting Guide as well. I'm not sure what the actual name of those guides are, but they're basic. One is a guideline and one is actual law. And we went around the school to see basically the amount of light emitted from these rooms, and we found that there was way too much energy or light being emitted from these lamps. So we're not only wasting energy, but that amount of light can be detrimental to our vision for so many hours at a time.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get down to the nitty-gritty.
All right,
can you tell me a little bit about your thesis?
Can you ask any other question? Is that...
Yeah.
No, I feel like this is the same response you get from every grad student working on their thesis. It's like, but at the same time, I'm definitely passionate about my research, But the main thing for my research is I use algae, more or less, as a proxy for human impact on freshwater environments. So I guess it ties into the whole paleolimnology thing.
All right. So can you explain to our listeners what paleolimnology is?
So paleolimnology. Limnology is the study of freshwater, freshwater lakes. And paleo is meaning the past. So I study past and present lakes to basically figure out what is occurring presently. So the key is, or the past is the key to the present. So if we're able to understand what has occurred in the past at these sites, we can understand how human impact has evolved these locations to the way they are today. But that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Yeah.
I guess what sort of applications can be found from your research?
Perfect. And that's a great question. So like I was said, I'm more interested in human impact on freshwater. So what I do to make it simple is I'll go to freshwater lakes and we can take a sediment core at these lakes. And these lakes are, the way they work, there's no oxygen at the bottom of the lake. So they preserve all the organic material that is held within the bottom of the lake. So essentially these lakes are time machines that hold everything that has been produced or fallen within its catchment. So we can take a core from a lake, and the deeper you go in the core is the farther you go in the past. So again, like I said, these are time machines. So we can take sediment samples going down the core. So not only can we date these sediment cores, we can also compare the amount of algae produced at these various depths, and we can actually link them to different events in our history. So a good example would be at my Walden Pond site, we see an increase in charcoal around 19 centimeters down, but then we also see a spike in planktonic forms of algae. And at first you're like, what is going on here? But if you actually refer to actual historical literature, on that lake there was actually a fire vent from the Ice Fork Cove fire of 1902, and it actually correlates directly to the charcoal and the amount of algae present at that depth as well. So again, a little bit of science here. If the fire occurred near the lake, if it rained, the amount of burnt material would be, I guess, washed into the lake. And with that comes nutrients that were burned, I guess, or associated with this event. So you have increased nutrient input into the lake, which then in turn gives you increased planktonic blooming. So lots of fun stuff.
Definitely. All right. So to sum it all up, we're building a chronology of lake sediments, and we're using algae as the proxy data for humans because we're saying that algae is basically what humans produce with all the increased activity. Is that correct?
More or less. So with increased human activity, you have increased nutrient cycles, and with that, you have increased algal production. Because algae, what we have to think about algae is they're primary producers. So they're the bottom of the food chain. So they respond first to any other changes in their ecosystem that are either natural or human influenced. So the whole point of using various types of algae, either green algae, dinoflagellates, cyanobacteria, or even the consumers that eat those various types of algae, if we can see the big picture of how everything has occurred in the past, we can use that for present situations. So a good example is, how has our algal assemblages evolved with response to human development? And with that, we're pioneering a way to use certain types of algae as proxies for various events that humans are involved in.
Absolutely. That's really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what have been the most challenging parts about completing your thesis?
That's a good question. I believe starting it, because you are assigned such a daunting task at first, and being able to conceptualize everything at first, it almost makes you want to kind of crawl up in a ball and quit because you just don't know where to start, how to start, but it's baby steps. You have to slowly analyze your samples, and like my supervisor says, the story will tell itself as long as you do proper science. Whether the story is positive to what you think may occur or complete opposite of your hypotheses, then hey, that's science. That's the way it works. So at the end of the day, you can't be discouraged about what your research brings up or what your research shows, I guess, at the end of the day. I was just lucky.
The story will be told.
Exactly. I was just lucky that at my sites, there's a much larger story developing than both my supervisor and I could have previously thought.
Wow.
So yeah, it's been really good so far.
Does that mean there's more opportunities for more research after you're done, or other master's students to be coming in and continuing your work?
Well, there's definitely always room for more master's students. All depends on if funding is involved. I think that's definitely an issue with academia, is finding proper funding, which
Absolutely.
Is unfortunate because it's such a pressing issue, water quality and how it relates to human impact. But As for the future of my research, I'm still on the fence. Mm-hmm. I've been in school for so long that I feel like after my master's, I kind of need to take a step back, smell the roses a bit in life, because I've been burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah.
I'd say, yeah. As much as I love my research, everyone needs to take a step back.
It takes a lot out of you. Yeah. But at the same time, what have some of your main passions been through your research? And have you had any rewarding experiences?
Ooh, good question. So relating to my actual research, I guess you could say that finally able to see how things develop after putting in work for so long.
Mm.
That's because at first your research is so much work with very, very little reward. And it really drags you down. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like I'm not getting anywhere in life. And then you start having like a quarter life crisis. Like, what am I doing? Is this even right? And yeah, I guess the trick is to get over your self-doubt is the best thing to say there. That's the most difficult hurdle, I'd say. But rewarding, I think it ties into the next question as well. I love being a TA. That's what I've noticed as well. I really enjoy helping students out, just so they can find not just their own passion, because you can see it when you teach kids. You can see when they're not only their eyes light up, but you can see when their passion is higher for a subject than others, and that's when you get the reward from teaching.
Awesome. Yeah. So what have been your favorite subjects to help students learn?
Now that's an even better question. Classes that don't involve a lot of hands-on work are harder to enjoy, because a lot of the times if they don't involve the hands-on work, the kids just won't come to lab.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point. If they know they can do the work from the comfort of their own home or outside of the classroom, they'll take that option 10 out of 10 times, most likely, unless they want help.
There's much less motivation.
Exactly. But if there's a class where there involves a lot of hands-on work, a good example would be the paleobiology class at TA. It's definitely not an easy course, but the fact that it entertains the idea of you need so much hands-on work to constantly look at the fossils, that's definitely more enjoyable, especially when I can actually drive across new ideas to especially biology students, because the course I TA is mainly an earth science biology course, but it's mostly dominated by biology students. So it's really interesting to see how I can help them make connections between geology and biology, and how that pertains to paleobiology and paleontology. And that's definitely a much more rewarding course than others I've taught.
So is anything interesting coming up in the Earth Science Department?
Oh, there always is. But more specifically, in a couple weeks, I'm participating in a grad student event. It's called The Mapping of New Knowledges, where I get to show off some of my research. And I'm pretty excited about that. I get to have a second round at that, because I originally started back in February when I attempted to do the 3-minute thesis. And that was a great opportunity, not only to see what other people are presenting, but also, I guess, practice for my thesis defense and my research in general. But no, I'm excited to present at this MNK. It's a poster, so I can put a lot more detail into it and really explain to the guests what my research is about. But I guess to segue into that, the main thing for my research that I will be presenting there is going to be called The Rise of the Green Algae. And it's basically talking about how I compared two very similar lakes in eastern Massachusetts. They're very similar in shape and size, although when European pilgrims came here, they did completely different things to these sites, to the point where their modern histories are completely diverged, where Walden Pond is more of a recreation site today, and Sluice Pond, the other site, is more of a urbanized site, so it's definitely more heavily impacted. But what's interesting, even though they've had both these lakes have had completely different modern histories, they've still developed a rise in the green algae, where in the past, before humans arrived at these locations, their primary producers were mainly dominated by cyanobacteria or dinoflagellates. And a lot of modern literature today states that a lot of cyanobacteria blooms, the harmful algal blooms, I guess you would say, on the Great Lakes, are directly correlated to the amount of or the degree of human impact by increased nutrients in the water and increased temperature from changing climate. It's, I guess, creating the perfect storm for these cyanobacterial blooms. But what's interesting is the total algal assemblage over time in the past century or so at both sites has completely shifted from cyanobacteria dominated to a green algae dominated algal assemblage. And at first, I didn't know what to make of this. But if you look historically, what has been going on, say, the past century or so that's never really happened in, say, the past 10,000 years of our history that we can go back in our sediment, and that's the burning of fossil fuels. Over the past century or so, since the Industrial Revolution began, we've been burning fossil fuels. And what we have to remember, green algae are really just relatives of land plants. They're meant to capture or sequester carbon dioxide. And us as humans burning all this excess carbon dioxide is essentially giving them a new niche to fill. They're just trying to grow, man. That's all they're trying to do. But yeah, that's basically a quick summary of what I'd like to present at MNK.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. It all really comes down to climate change, doesn't it?
It does. Everything's connected.
Yeah. All right. What is the most mind-blowing fact you have ever learned within all your years of earth science?
I think this actually ties in to what I just previously said, how everything's connected. If you think about it, if you really open your eyes, you can understand how everything is connected. And a good quote, I guess, by Henry David Thoreau, who actually made Walden Pond famous, one of my sites, is, it's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. We can look at everything that the world has to offer, but if we're not actually looking deep enough and making connections, we're not going to understand everything. And that's what I've realized with my research is, everything is connected, almost like the butterfly effect, especially in sciences, at least, how one thing may influence another. And I guess my whole point here is you have to keep an open mind, especially with science, and you can't lock yourself into one idea. And sharing your ideas is huge. You need to be able to communicate not only for your sake, but for the sake of all science. And it's unfortunate, I think, where we're going today is just lack of education. And if there's one thing I could try to push, I guess, is we need more education and for everything. And it's not that people are dumb, not by any means. It's just they haven't been given the opportunity. Because people are very intelligent. And I think if you just give them the opportunity to gain more knowledge, then we can make the world a better place.
Absolutely. And you're tying right into what the show is all about, because we are just looking to educate the general public that geography is out there and that you use it in your daily lives, even if you don't really think about it. And geography and earth science are very closely connected.
Absolutely.
And we also have our own rule. It's actually the first law of geography, which is everything is related to everything else, but nearer things are more related than distant ones. And that's Tobler's Law, who passed away last month, as we talked about. Anyway, so I'd like to thank you so, so much for coming in. It's been an awesome interview.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. It's been a great opportunity. Take care.
Joining us in the studio today is Kyle Rankin. He is currently finishing up his final year at Brock University, doing the Human Geography program with a concentration in geomatics. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into your research and what you're currently doing through Brock, I want to sort of step back and ask you about like your educational path to where you are now. Were you always interested in geography, and who are some of your influences in high school, I guess it would have been, to pursue geography?
So in high school, I actually started out wanting to be a teacher, and I'd wanted to be a teacher for the longest time. And I went into Brock in the Con Ed program with goals of being a teacher. And then I was sitting in class and I was like, I don't know if I really like this. And geography was always kind of something that I excelled at in high school. And I wouldn't say my influences came so much from high school, but I was sitting in second year geomatics class with Marilyn Jolino, and she's probably the one that kind of set me off in the GIS kind of pathway there. And I was like, that's really interesting. I like this. I'm good at it. So that's what I switched into when I knew I didn't want to be a teacher anymore.
You have a wide variety. Well, first of all, we should say that you are the final student that has gone through the concentration in geomatics program between Brock University and Niagara College. Because I believe that is a program that is no longer available. How lucky do you feel to have gone through that?
Oh, extremely lucky. It was actually right up until April of the year before that I was not in that program, and they reinstated it and we brought back there. So I'm very thankful that I got to take part in that.
Yeah, for listeners that don't know, at one point in time, you were able to take your four-year bachelor's degree at Brock and do the postgraduate certificate at Niagara College. And so essentially getting a five-year education in 4 years. Can you talk to us a little bit about your experience in the Niagara College program?
I absolutely loved it. I learned so much that I don't think that I would, not that I wouldn't learn it at university, but it's such a hands-on thing, and I think that's what goes with the college-type atmosphere, and it's learning through doing and just getting through that, and I learned so much, and not just about GIS and cartography or programming, stuff like that. It's I kind of grew as a person and more skills than just GIS, I think.
So part of the Niagara College program is the thesis project. And I see that you've worked, your thesis project was working with the Canadian Border Services Agency. Can you tell us a little bit about what that project was?
I'll tell you what I'm allowed to, because some of it was confidential. But we analyzed cross-border marine travel. So that's people going in their personal boats, their pleasure craft from the States into Canada. So we analyzed some trends in that data and identified certain areas that require heightened awareness, certain hotspots or areas that are more susceptible to bad guys, we'll say.
Now, did that turn into your current internship or is that difference?
So they're all at the Great Lakes Marine Security Operations Center, just in Niagara-on-the-Lake. So there's Transport Canada, Border Services, RCMP. And the lady that I had worked with, Bonnie Martins from the CBSA, she kind of hooked me up with the people at Transport Canada, and it's worked out really well.
Yeah, Bonnie's a fantastic geospatial technician, all-around great person. I've known her for quite a few years. And I guess we should also note that Kyle is the recipient of the 2018,
I guess.
I'm thinking in terms because we're talking we'll be talking about hockey. The Esri Scholarship for 2017-2018 at Brock University, and he has an absolutely fascinating project working with the Brampton Beast of the ECHL, and he's using GIS and geospatial technologies in a hockey context. So take as much time as you want to describe this project because it is absolutely utterly fascinating. And I don't think sports analytics is on the top of mind when thinking about geospatial technology. So can you let our listeners know how that came about and what the project is all about?
Well, I've been pretty much playing hockey my entire life. Didn't make anything of it. That's why I'm in university. But I still like to play and I still like to be involved with it. So I really wanted to take what I was passionate about in hockey and what I was passionate about in GIS and kind of make them one. So I reached out first to someone with the Niagara Ice Dogs. I thought the local connection would be good. But he put me forward to this guy, Frederick LeMay, with the Brampton Beast. And he's actually a Brock grad himself. So he's very happy to let me assist them this year. But going on to the actual project, the ECHL does track where the shots go during each game. So where the player is taking the shot towards the net. But they're not doing anything with it. And I looked at it and I was like, that's a map. So I took those points and I digitized them into an exact scale hockey rink that I had also digitized. And I used those to use a kernel density or kind of a heat map type thing. And it would highlight areas where the team is taking most of their shots and where they're scoring a lot of their goals. And it also highlighted some areas which would be very important for them to try and get their shots and their goals from. So basically, we'd look at where they're scoring from, and it would be, say, right in the middle in front of the net. And then he can go and show his players, hey, this is where you need to shoot from. And one of the things that I had said to the Brampton Beast when we were talking about the project was, like, I'm not going to teach you anything new about the game of hockey, but it's a way to communicate with people. And I think people really get maps and GIS type stuff more because it's visual. And I'm not just saying to you, hey, you have a 50% chance of scoring from here. I'm giving you this piece of paper and it's going to say, hey, look at this. This is science. It's statistical. And I made the geodatabase too so that it can be queried and bring out further trends in the data. So I recorded who they're playing against, what period it was in, the time that the shot was taken at, and which player took the shot. So even at the end of the season, you can look up and I can say, let's see where Darren shot from this year. We can see all the shots that he took and all the goals that he took. And then I could print this out and say, this is where you're shooting from, but this is where you're scoring. So you can adjust your play on the ice from that. And maybe it's not an exact science because hockey's such a fast game, But I do think it's an aid, and maybe not so much at the pro level, because these guys are professionals, but bringing it to lower levels of hockey when you have a little kid that's not paying attention to anything, but this is something that they can really connect with and see where they're what they're doing.
I noticed, too, that you actually even have the goalie that it was against.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they, you know, depending if it's a left-handed or right-handed goalie in terms of catching hand and blocking hand and stuff. I find this absolutely fascinating, and I'm flattered that you would think I would actually score goals in a hockey game. So we've seen, I mean, if anybody watches any of the major networks, hockey games, I mean, like you said, they do record the shot locations. Did you have any trouble convincing the organization that you could bring something different to what they might already collect?
Yes and no. I had, like I said, I first talked to the Niagara Ice Dogs, and I made them a sample of the work, and they showed their coaches, and I think their coach was one of those old school guys that says, well, I know hockey, what's this guy going to teach me about hockey? But he led me to the Brampton Beast, and I think the Brampton Beast were more like a younger management group, and they could see the benefit from this technology. And I think that's really a hard part of it, is convincing them that I can help, rather just like, I've been around hockey 20 years, I know everything.
Was this kind of like a visual money ball type of project?
That's what I said actually in my presentation for the Esri scholarship, that sports analytics is getting big, and you can see it even in the movies. So this is exactly like that, statistics on a sheet of paper.
So to the best of your knowledge, does the incorporation of GIS to sports analytics exist anywhere in hockey? I mean, are you pulling off a first for this type of research?
I don't think so. I think the NHL does use it. There is a database that you can kind of look through. I don't know if it's as extensive as what I was doing in counting shots and taking percentages of different areas. But of course, the NHL is multi-billion-dollar industry, so they're going to have the resources to do that. But even at the ECHL level with the Brampton Beast, maybe money's a little bit tighter and they can't afford a gigantic analytics department and GIS licenses, but something like what I did with the project that could possibly be developed into an app, would be the end goal of it, is something that could be available to all levels of the sport and really trickle down even to the minor hockey level.
So are you looking forward to pushing the research forward and turning this into an app?
Yeah, so I do have the main goal would be to create this kind of standalone app that would kind of work on an iPad system that parents would have, say, at the game, and they're putting in the points as the game happens, where the shots are being taken. And this may not necessarily even be just for hockey. I'd also like to explore kind of moving it to different sport platforms. All it would really take would be digitizing like an official size field for soccer or football or even basketball. So I think that it speaks to maybe not even just the project, but GIS as a whole, at how applicable and flexible it is to different industries.
Have you approached the sport management program at Brock University at all about this?
I have not, but I have been told that I should. It's something that I definitely consider, because I know I have a couple friends in that program, and they do some analytics and statistics types projects. So I'd love to partner with Brock again to do that as well.
Because I think what we need here in Niagara is some spin-off business generation for different products. And I think this would be absolutely fantastic for Niagara to be able to do, and yourself to be able to do. So thanks a lot for coming in. We really appreciate your time and all the work that you've done, and looking forward to hearing more about how this project progresses in the future.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
So we want to thank all of our guests for coming in and spending the time to sit down with us so we can learn a little bit more about their projects and their goals.
Yes, definitely.
Before we get to our events, I just wanted to share a couple little sites with you. I actually stumbled upon a podcast called Podship Earth, and that's hosted by a gentleman by the name of Jared Blumenfeld. And I will post a link to that show, the podcast description, in the show notes. It seemed to be a pretty wide variety of topics. The episode that I actually stumbled in on was the citizen science episode, which was really neat. And another resource that I discovered was the Geo Lounge YouTube channel. And on there are several tips and tricks, and also a wide variety of educational videos for geography and geology. So we'll post that link in the show notes as well.
Awesome. Those sound really good.
As this week is Earth Week, you can only imagine the amount of events that are happening in the community.
Oh, so many. And it's so great that like more and more people are getting involved with geography related events in their own communities and stepping outside of their comfort zones to go explore their own backyards or other places.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. This is like the, for a geographer or environmental student, this is like Christmas to them.
Yeah, it absolutely is. There's events all over the place right now.
So by no means is this an extensive list of events that are happening for Earth Week. Mm-hmm. I encourage you to check your local municipal websites because they're always looking for volunteers for different events during Earth Week and Earth Day. But the St. Catharines Clean City Advisory Committee has their community cleanup happening on Saturday. Several community groups, namely the Port Dalhousie Beautification and Works Committee and Fitzgerald Neighbors, have their respective neighborhood cleanups on the same day at the same time. So Port Dalhousie's is Saturday the 21st of April at 10 a.m. till noon, and they will be meeting at the Alley Beach Bar and Grog House off of Lock Street in Port Dalhousie. The Fitzgerald Neighbors Group will be meeting at the west side of Catherine Street Park on Russell Avenue, 10 a.m. on Saturday, April 21st as well, and I've been told that there is going to be coffee at all of these events. As much as I love geography and environmental studies, coffee also works. Other pitching activities are planned in St. Catharines. Currently, there are four locations: the QEW off-ramp at Lake Street, the QEW off-ramp at Ontario Street, and unfortunately, these locations can have no kids under 12. But the former Fairview Mall golf course, they will be meeting by the PetSmart, and at Roehampton Park, where the CNR spur line is at 55 Roehampton Avenue. There'll be cleanup events going on there. So bring your gloves and any device to pick up trash, and remember to dress for the weather. On Thursday, April 26th at 7:30 p.m., the St. Catharines Museum at Lock 3 is presenting Dr. Lawrence Stevens and his presentation, Turney's Crossroads, A Portrait Through Time, an illustrative presentation of the intersection through time of culture and landscape in the area surrounding the point once known as Turney's Crossroads. And I will post a flyer for that presentation. It looks to be very interesting. Turney's Corners is actually now submerged underwater. I guess it's a sort of a holding pond or of some sort of form for the Welland Canal. And then what would Earth Week be without tree planting events? The Pelham Community Tree Planting Event is being held on Friday, April 27th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at Centennial Park, and that is at 999 Church Street. The other tree planting event is happening in Niagara Falls, and that will be Saturday, May the 5th from 10 a.m. till noon, meeting at the Rapids View parking lot, which is near Kingsbridge Park near Chippewa. Niagara Falls Community Clean Sweep Day is Saturday, May the 12th. Volunteers are to meet at the Milk and Angelo's Eatery and Bar parking lot for 9 a.m. to collect cleaning supplies and further instructions, I guess, where they want you to head out and clean. And I'm sorry I'm hopping around. There's just so many events.
So many.
Sunday, May 6th, there will be a guided hiking tour of the second Welland Canal put on by the Welland Canal's Advocate, and that is from noon until 2, and they will be meeting at the Westside Sobeys parking lot at the Mountain Locks Plaza on Glendale Avenue. And as I mentioned before, my experience with that hike that I just went on, it was incredible to learn the history of the Welland Canals. It was really fun. It was a good day out. And finally, two Go Geomatics meetups to announce. Saturday, April the 28th, between 6:30 and 9:30 at Fresco's, 104th Avenue. And then the May meetup is Saturday, May the 26th, between 6:30 and 9:30 at the same location. Wow.
Wow. Nice job, Darren.
Thank you.
That was a mouthful.
So do you want to do how you can connect with us?
Yeah. So you can find us on our Facebook page at GeoNiagara Radio Show. And you can find us on Twitter at GeoNiagara. And you can also email us. Our email is
geospatialniagara@gmail.com.
So that does it for our show for the evening. Our next episode will air Wednesday, May 23rd, 6 p.m., right here on 103.7 CFBU.
And for all of us at the GeoNiagara Radio Show, I'm Darren.
And I'm RJ.
Have a great night.
Thanks for listening.
You've
You have been listening to the Geo Niagara Radio Show, sponsored by the Department of Geography and Tourism Studies at Brock University.